Welcome, everybody. Special episode of the No Code Podcast. It's been a couple years. It's been 2 years since I've done one of these. And now, only way to bring it back into focus here is with my dad, the great Phil Giuliano. Welcome, Phil.
Well, that's an overstatement about the great, but glad to be with you, Tony.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So today, we're going to do, this could be a long one, because we're going to do a full retrospective of the life of Phil Giuliano from September 13th, 1947 to today, as much detail as possible. And we're going to talk about career stuff, sports, family, the whole gamut. So, sound good?
Yeah, I just hope I don't scare anybody. I'm ready.
All right, great stuff. So let's start it. Let's start it in the early days of Atlantic City, the birthplace, hometown of you.
Well, I could go on a long time about this, and I'll try to be as succinct as possible. But I do want to share some details that are, I think you'll find interesting, especially if you use the Atlantic City of today. It was not what you see in Boardwalk Empire, though I will admit I'm watching the whole thing over again. It's quite an interesting story. But it wasn't that at all. You know, Atlantic City was a fun place to grow up in. I grew up on Atlantic Avenue before there were malls. And Atlantic Avenue was just lined with stores on the right side, on the north side, and on the south side, from about California Avenue all the way up to about Pennsylvania Avenue. And all you did was run up and down the streets in order to get whatever you needed, whatever wares you were looking for. They had everything. Shoes, food. They even had a tinsmith. I don't know what he did.
I don't know what a tinsmith is.
Neither do I. Okay. And I lived on top of them. They had dry cleaners. They had everything you needed right on Atlantic Avenue. So there was no need for a mall. You shopped Atlantic Avenue. Easy walking. Easy. A lot of fun. And so I grew up there. And what happened was, what people don't understand is that Atlantic City was at that time 64,000 people. Today it's about 30,000.
Wow.
It had about six obvious neighborhoods. Had the Inlet, had the North Side, West Side, had Venice Park, had Ducktown, it had Chelsea, and then it had Chelsea Heights, and then it had the south of the monument, which is like, I don't know what it was called, Upper Chelsea maybe, and it was more Ventnor-like. But it was a place you could get around on your bike and do just about anything you wanted to do. I was actually lived in the era with the trolley going down the middle of Atlantic Avenue. And that didn't last too long in my youth. Eventually it was replaced by buses. But I used to just enjoy, as I grew up, enjoy all the different neighborhoods for what they offered, especially in sports, which every neighborhood had teams and you played against one another. And that's really all the competition that you needed. And it was, the boardwalk was not as glamorous as people say, everybody dressing and all that, but they did dress on holidays like Easter and whatnot. That was a big, big holiday.
I can remember going up on the Easter boardwalk when I was a kid even. You know, right. Me and Paul have a classic picture of us in our ill-fitting suits when we're about 7 and 5. So my shoes that look like they're probably a size 10, and I was probably a size 4 at the time. So
I got to tell an Easter story I might go to jail for, but I want to tell it anyway.
That's okay.
It was my first date. The girl's name, I'll never forget it, Doris Fritz. And she lived in Chelsea Heights. So I had to walk from Georgia Avenue, where I lived, between Georgia and Florida, to Chelsea Heights to pick her up, then go on the boardwalk and walk up to the where the games were played. That's about what our interest was, you know, maybe getting cotton candy and games played. I had $2 and she had $1.
And how old are you in this story?
Third grade.
Third grade. Okay.
Right, third grade. I forgot that part. But okay. Anyway, we're playing. All we did was take the $3 and play skee ball. I took her dollar and played it. And then when it came time to walk home, I got to Georgia Avenue and I said, Doris, you got to make it on your own. I don't know what her parents thought. I never went out with her again. But it's true stories to help me guys.
Hey, Doris, thanks for listening, by the way. And we hope you're well. We hope you found a nice partner in life and everything's okay.
And they walk you home at night.
Oh, my gosh.
So anyway, when it came to go time to go to school, my father was Italian. My mother was Irish. And they started probably feuding at a pretty early part of the wedding. And I think my mother of the marriage. And I think my mother was a little perturbed at my father and decided that a guy who lived on Georgia Avenue, who played in the schoolyard at St. Michael's with all the Italian kids, was brown skinned, especially at the start of school, right? Tan from the summer, should go to Star to Sea instead of going to St. Michael's. Well, I immediately became a traitor in my own neighborhood. But I did it. I went 8 years to Star to Sea. And actually what happened was I met a whole new bunch of friends. And I still kept my Ducktown friends until eighth grade. And in eighth grade, I was a pretty good basketball player. And we played against them two times. And we crushed them. And I remember I got 26 each game. And they hated me, like you can't believe. They were calling me names when we were in their gym. They were. I didn't throw anything at me, but they certainly wanted to. And, but you know, as time went by, that moved on. And like I said, I had two sets of friends, and a lot of fun growing up in Atlantic City. We actually had a summer baseball league in the morning, where kids came from all over the city to play in. And none of that exists today. It's time going by.
Speaking of baseball in the morning, do you remember the one time that you took Paul and I for batting practice before school? We were probably middle school. Remember how that went?
Yeah, I do. First of all, I called for a 6 a.m. practice. And I said, look, it's baseball. We got to get ahead of the game. I was a baseball fanatic. I was teaching you guys how to play the game. And at 6 a.m., I picked you up. And to tell you the truth, it was the most wasteful time of my life. You were about as ready to play as the man in the moon.
Yeah.
And still, I made you take all the batting practice I could. I threw to you as much as I could. I hit you ground balls and him fly balls. And you probably went home saying, I'll never do this again.
And we never did.
And we never did.
That was the one morning practice.
We never rescheduled.
Never did. No. I think I think
ironically, that was when I was a baseball coach later off in life, I had two days.
Did you?
I did it. Yeah. I did it again. They all showed up. And they were all just as pissed off, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Well, you fell in love with baseball at an early age.
Yeah, I did.
And it carried on to Paul and I, you know, we both played in college,
right.
and you played a little ball in college yourself too.
Right.
And it's been a part of our family for a long time.
Yeah, it surely has. It's you know, something that I'll never forget. You know, it started in Little League. I was a pretty good player, and went on to Babe Ruth, and we didn't have travel leagues back there. Well, we had a good Babe Ruth program. We had a city program. And all the teams in the city played. I remember that my 13-year-old year, I started. I was a catcher, and we were undefeated. We didn't lose a game all year. Beat some teams from out of town as well, and played with two great guys, Bobby Feather and Johnny Goff. They were terrific players. And anyway, it just spurred me on to where I just wanted to continue to play in high school. And I played in high school and had a pretty good career in high school. Can I share some high school moments?
Absolutely. That's what we're here to do.
I had one problem in high school. My senior year, I was going to be the second pitcher. Our first pitcher was getting drafted. He was a 90-mile-an-hour plus guy back in 1964 and 63 with a big, giant curveball. And that just wasn't seen too much. We'd have 20 scouts at the game. And so I was playing, my senior year, a couple of the lesser pitchers who were very good graduated, and I thought I'd be the second pitcher. Well, lo and behold, the coach decides he's going to pitch a junior against teams that we're going to beat. We were 16-1. We only lost one game by a run. And he decides that he's going to pitch this fella these five games, and I'm not going to pitch. He tells me, you might be too wild, he says. Okay, all right. So anyway, the kid goes 5-0. I don't pitch. I'm playing positions and whatnot. And finally he comes up to me and says, you know, we got a pretty tough game tomorrow. Do you want to pitch? I said, Coach, there were five games I could have pitched. You could have saw me pitch. You could have been convinced that I was the right guy. Now you want me to pitch the tough games? I said, I'd love to try it. And I went out and beat a team, pretty good team, and I struck out 13 guys. Okay? Which the kid that was before me couldn't strike out five. All right. So now we get another tough game. He says, well, you did pretty good. Do you want to do it again? I said, yeah, I do want to do it again. And we won, close game, and I struck out 13 guys again. So here I was in high school, 2-0 with 26 strikeouts. Add the other five games and the strikeouts I could have had in the game, and I make all everything, all everything. Instead, I made all nothing. And it was a heartbreaker, but the lesson learned.
Yeah. Well, you also, I remember a story from your high school years in sports of a pretty big football game that was played at Boardwalk Hall, right? Or Convention Hall?
Yeah, I went into high school as a basketball first, baseball player second, football player third. I didn't even go out my freshman year. And I thought I was all it in basketball. Soon to find out that I was a 5'11 Italian guy whose ability was degrading fast. But I could run, right? So my sophomore year, I went out in football. And I was so far from playing at the start of sophomore year, I just was so proud to have my number that you could see up in the stands. And, you know, all the students saying, oh, that's Phil, you know. Even though I didn't think I'd ever get in a game my sophomore year. Didn't believe I would. First game went by, I didn't even see the field. Second game comes up, we go to practice the next day, and the coach says, Giuliano, you're now the right end. I said, Coach, are you sure? I was 5'11". I weighed 115 pounds.
Beanpole.
Yeah, I was model's weight. And so I played the whole season, caught a lot of balls, was having a good season. But then we were going to go into Convention Hall, 12,000 people, and we were going to play against the mighty Atlantic City High School. And back then, the paper used to cover local sports much more intensely. And we were 7-touchdown underdog. So went out there. We moved the ball pretty well. We were winning a moral victory for sure. And we get down around, I don't know, the 20 or the 30. And the play comes in, I'll never forget the numbers, 129-3, right 129-3. And that was me on a 10-yard out. So I run the 10 yards, I turn out, I'll be goddamn the ball's there. I catch it, I turn upfield, I'm running and running until I ran into the stage at the Convention Hall. Because I said, guess what, I just scored a touchdown. I thought my father was going to have an aneurysm. And as a sophomore, I scored a touchdown. And you know, and that was one of the highlights of my football career. Went on to have a good junior year, senior year. Our tailback left, and that's in the single wing is what we ran. And they called it today, it's a shotgun quarterback today. Back then it was a tailback. He graduated, and we were 4-0 and hadn't completed a pass. Didn't even throw one. Ah. And so I was the right end in misery, just blocking every play. And that was a shame because I was really wanted to have a big senior year. But you have to have somebody to throw you a ball.
That's true. Sort of necessary. But 12,000 people to watch a high school football game.
Oh, I forgot the half of the story.
Okay.
About half the story. In a smoke-filled room. right? I don't know about the air conditioning, not sure. And with a coach that didn't believe in us drinking water, okay? So now I'm playing on offense and I'm doing my job. All of a sudden our safety gets hurt. Well, who's second string safety? Me. So they put me in the game to play defense. Now I'm playing defense and offense, right? And they call a defense, a 6-3 defense, right? Which puts me at middle linebacker. And I said, what am I doing here?
115-pound middle linebacker. It's good.
And the other team had an all-state player who was phenomenal. Joe Jacobs was his name. Phenomenal. First team all-state, which was impossible to get elected that in South Jersey. It just didn't happen. The North Jersey kids won most of those awards. But he was phenomenal. He was so tough, so big. Well, here he comes through the hole. I said, oh, my God. I'm ready to retreat. I mean, I don't know what to do. Somehow, a guy got a little piece of him on a tackle. I went behind him and tackled him and called it the biggest victory of my life. It was bigger than the touchdown, to be honest with you, if you know the truth. And, that was that game that day. And went on to play two more in the hall. And they were always exciting events.
I mean, that's just that crowd size is unbelievable. But back then, that's what people did. It was a big high school.
Well, it was the Wednesday before Thanksgiving.
Okay.
So it attracted everybody, and they all wanted to meet up with everybody. You know, so that's what created another thing that added to the crowd.
Yeah.
And of course, the Atlantic City people wanted to see us get beat by 7 touchdowns. We were a Catholic school. With a population, I think by my senior year, this is my sophomore year, we had about 400 or 500 kids. They had 4,200. So they had guys that never played for them that could have started for us.
Right.
Plenty of them. You know? Unfortunately, for them, they should have came almost here.
So what was the final of that game?
21-6, but we got a lot of yards against them. And moved the ball against them embarrassingly. So
yeah, and you had the one touchdown.
Yeah. They should be ashamed of themselves.
I'm sure they still are.
The yards they gave up that day to us.
Well, that's an amazing story. Before we move on to the college years, I did want to ask you about the social scene in Atlantic City for young people, high school age, and particularly our good recently departed family friend, Jerry Blabbitt, the Geeter with the heater.
Wow. God, I miss him.
From what you described, he would come into town and have some incredibly epic dances that he would DJ and parties that he would MC. And obviously that became his life. And, fast forward many years later to Memories and Margate and what that became. But what was the early Geeter days like in Atlantic City?
First of all, he actually had a dance at an old theater near my house. And it was about four houses down. And it was called The Lyric. And he actually had a dance there. And of course I went and got in a fight and, remember that very well. Then he had other dances. The one dance he had was at the Jefferson Ballroom. I'll never forget this dance. Because he now tells a story that's not true. He told this story. We told this story many times over the radio and in person. But the Jefferson Ballroom, mixed dance, white and black, right? Great party, great time. And Jerry introduces a guy on the stage, says, here's this guy. He's going to sing his new song, Fingertips. Comes on the stage and he's staring out over the audience. And it's none other than Stevie Wonder. So I don't know if I'm Stevie Wonder at this time. So Jerry tells a story that I came up to him after he said, Stevie, look at the crowd out there. Look at them all dancing. Look at everybody out there. And I came up and I started tugging at his Jerry's pants saying, Jerry, he's blind. He can't see. And we told that story over and over again. It did not happen. But But Blavitt thought that it did. In his mind, it did happen.
Don't let the truth get in the way of a good story.
I miss him dearly. He called me regularly. Stayed in touch with me regularly, and I stayed in touch with him all the time.
I always enjoyed seeing him. We had a couple dinners together.
Yeah.
You know, he was very good to our family, and a great loss for the whole Philadelphia region, especially. And we'll talk about him a little later as we get into some of the casino years later on into the early 2000s, mid 2000s. But so let's talk about, you know, you go through high school, sports, get good grades, all that stuff. And it's time to figure out where to go to college. And for you, I believe I'm correct, first person in your family to venture into college, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So what was that process like? How were you trying to figure it out? And where'd you wind up?
Well, it was a busy, busy year for colleges because 1965 is the age limit is after the war, 1947 to 1965. If you do the math, right, 18 years, 17 years, 18 years, colleges were bursting at the seams, and there really weren't enough of them. Okay,
right.
And so a few places I applied, I didn't get accepted, and I was astonished that I didn't. So I had to come up with a secondary plan, and I did the college admissions thing for the nation, and it was just you send in one application and they forwarded your application to everybody. I got into 54 colleges then. I remember one of them was Pepperdine.
Oh.
And I couldn't. I even then I knew that the number was too big, you know, that my parents couldn't afford that.
Yeah.
But it was exciting to see it. I ended up the University of Pittsburgh because they promised if you go to a branch campus that after 1 year of a successful year academically that you could transfer to the main campus, and that attracted me. Little did I know how expensive it was, right? I didn't really pay attention to that one. So I picked something we knew. All the kids from the shore knew about this town, these two towns really, Johnstown and Altoona. And this campus was in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Well, I hope there's nobody listening from Johnstown, but that was a penalty and a half. I mean, we took a 10-hour bus ride out there. I got my chest of clothes and whatnot. And the cab driver that we got off the bus, he took us to see the high water marks of the floods. That was all I could see. There was nothing else.
Interesting, yeah.
So I went to school there for one semester. And I was smart enough to realize that if all the kids from New York and Philly and all over were in this school, and they were all floundering. You know, they were all bad GPAs, failing stuff. I said, no, 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 no. I'm getting out of here as fast as I can get out of here. And I remember I got a 3.0. And I called my father and said, Dad, I'm transferring. I got to go somewhere. He said, let me call the baseball coach at LaSalle. And he did. And I went for an interview at LaSalle. I think I could have got in on my own without the baseball thing. And all my friends at LaSalle were floundering. They just weren't mature enough to go to college. You know, they weren't street people, you know, in any way. And they didn't know how to manage certain things. Whereas I thought I had an edge that way. And I could read the professors. I knew how to manage my time. And anyway, long story short, I went to LaSalle and graduated in 7 semesters, right? You had to back then. The Vietnam War was getting hot and heavy and got real heavy my senior year. As a matter of fact, before I got my teaching job, I was classified 1A upon graduation and told to report to Missouri Avenue where the bus left for Trenton to get processed. And there were some scary days. Then I got the teaching job, which gave me a deferment.
This was 69 or 70?
This was 69.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, 1969. And it was, they hadn't given you the numbers yet,
mm-hmm.
but it was hot and heavy, hot and heavy.
Now, LaSalle, there was it was an interesting time to be there because, as you've told me many times, the basketball program was phenomenal, although I think they were on suspension, probation for some violations. But the basketball team was incredible. But all the Philly school, most of the Philly schools at the time had very elite programs nationally. And I remember you describing me those games, not just those games, but the freshman games too.
Well, first of all, you couldn't play as a freshman. You couldn't play on varsity and you couldn't dunk the ball, right? So that's how different. There was no 3-point line. All right. So that's the game. So the freshman game between LaSalle and Villanova, they were, Villanova was good. LaSalle was good. LaSalle was completely recruited by a dry cleaner by the name of Joey Walters, I believe is his name. And some of the enticements, you know, were, you know, to say the least, they weren't legal.
So Joey the dry cleaner is just handing out, you know, whatever he's handing out.
Everybody got a new
duffel
car.
Bags of cash, yeah, new cars.
I don't know if they got cash every right. week. I'm not sure of that.
But right.
They became, a lot of them became acquaintances, if not friends of mine. And they were great players. And so anyway, the freshman game was more attended, more highly attended than the varsity game because, well, it actually wasn't, but per seat it was. You couldn't get in because it was at Villanova. And I'll never forget that. It was an incredible situation leading up to the senior year when the Big Five back then was, you know, for anybody that's listening that's of age, was just a great, great, great league. And that year, the teams were all very good. I think St. Joe's made the tournament. I know Villanova made the tournament. We were on probation, would have made the tournament easily. I'll explain that in a second. And Temple played in the NIT and won it. So, and Penn was coming. They were coming along. And anyway, it was a great league. It was incredible. The games, we attended all the games. I was allowed to go in for free because I used to ref all the intramural games for the fellow that Stan, I forget his last name. He ran the security at, or the facility at the Palestra. So I used to just go down there and he just let me in. And somehow I found a seat. I don't know if there were assigned seats then or not, but whatever.
By the way, just to interject, that's a similar scam that I ran at Villanova. I played baseball my freshman year and we got into the games for free because we would clean up the stands after the game. Well, I just kept all my baseball gear from freshman year, and then sophomore, junior, and senior year, I would wear that gear and tell them I was cleaning up after the game. So even if I didn't have a lottery ticket, I got into the game.
Well, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
We figure our way around things.
I had no money. I had no money. So
yeah.
I had to do whatever I could do to survive. That's an interesting story in and of itself. So anyway, we finished 23-1 that year. We lost one game, the Holiday Festival. We lost to John Roach and South Carolina, 55-52. I'll never forget that game. And I believe all five of our starting five played professional basketball. A couple of them played in the NBA. Larry Cannon got some time in the NBA. Kenny Durrett played in the NBA until he got hurt. And the rest of the guys played in the ABA. And they were all reasonable scorers and reasonable performers. And they weren't just bench warmers or anything like that. They were a great team. And had we had the three-point shot, I don't think anybody in the world would have beat us. We used to shoot jumpers from high and say, oh, my God, don't take that shot. And we get 2 points for it. And today, it would have been three.
Yeah. So those teams, that whole experience, I'm sure was pretty incredible. And at that same time, your good buddy Chris Ford from Atlantic City, who also recently passed, was doing amazing things at Villanova, including going to the championship game in 1971.
Well, that's a great, I got to give you some Chris Ford time. Chris Ford grew up in my neighborhood, I hung around with him a little bit. He used to come to my house. He used to come to our friend's house, Donnie D. And he was almost as old as we were, but he was two grades behind. So he used to play a little baseball. I was playing some baseball with him. And I'll never forget when I told him, Chris, give up this baseball. Start playing basketball all the time. Because you got 2 years left in school. I'm going into high school. You still got to go to seventh and eighth grade. By the time you come out of there, how good will you be? Plus, he kept growing. That's what we used to call him, wheat. And he was growing and growing and growing. And he's the greatest guy in life, nicest guy. Making me choke up a little bit. He was quality human being. And I miss him dearly. And I was sick when they had his funeral, and I couldn't attend his funeral. And I regret that to this day. I wrote something in the paper, or online, I guess it was, on Facebook, that a lot of people read, and it was from the heart. And Chris Ford was one of Atlantic City's top representatives, and he was certainly Ducktown's king.
Yeah, I can remember in the Ducktown Tavern, I think you guys were having a grade school reunion, and Chris came, and, you know, obviously larger than life guy, but a gentle giant, and a very sweet person.
Very, very, very nice.
And that's a rare find in that business. I mean, he was an NBA player and coach for years, and a lot of times that hardens people, and not him. Never forgot where he came from and was always willing to give people the time of day. And yeah, he's definitely, there were some great things written about him after he passed, and it was good to hear those words, but a sad loss for everybody. Certainly. Yeah.
Great word, Harden. He was not Harden.
No. So the college years come and go. You paid for a lot of it on your own, I think, as you've told me, driving that PBR truck in the summer, right?
I drove a beer truck in the summer. I got paid union wages, which was a nice pay at that time. But the work was hard. I'd go in at 200 pounds. I'd finish at about 165 for the summer. My belt would be one spot, and I'd be tying it by the end of the summer. Worked my butt off.
No air conditioning in that truck.
No. All the other beer companies had helpers and they had forklifts that loaded the beers. We loaded the beer and delivered the beer, and it was hard work. And then at nights I would work at the pharmacy next to where I moved, because I made a big move. I forgot to include this. I moved from Atlantic Avenue to Arctic Avenue, which was a block away, right? And the reason we moved is that on the Arctic Avenue apartment, they had some wall-to-wall carpet. In the Atlantic Avenue, all they had was linoleum. So this was an upscale move, even though it was a small apartment. And I only lived there really 1 year, because after I graduated college, I never went back to permanently live there. Though I would come in and have dinner and whatnot, be with my mother and father.
We're talking about summer, college summers, but I was leading into after college.
Even in the, after college, I taught school, 2 years in Pleasantville, then 9 years at Langsley High School. And I, you know, had this love of baseball, and I love sports. Used to hang around the basketball team, but the baseball job, the JV job, became open while I was there. I took that for a year. And then my head coach resigned. I took the varsity job for 4 years. We had a very successful 4-year run. Won 70% of our games. Sent about 5 guys to Division I. And one guy to the minor leagues. A couple of the other guys, very accomplished in the conference they played in. One fellow made all conference in the Ivy League. And used baseball as a springboard into an incredible career. Fell in the minor leagues. He's a giant t- today in the Philadelphia scene. And he was Villanova's leading baseball player, a leading home run hitter for the longest time. I think he finally somebody broke his record. And he used to throw out the first pitch. He has thrown out the first pitch of the season for Villanova. But anyway, that was a lot of fun. But I had this other burning ambition while I was doing that. And I had a lot of athleticism left in me. And I was a physical fitness borderline fanatic. So I was looking for something to stay in shape. And I got into the game of racquetball. And I became pretty proficient in it. And matter of fact, I moved all the way up to where I was the club pro at the big facility that opened here. Racquetball was a fad. It slowed down quite a bit since then. But when I was involved in it, a facility would have 16 courts and they'd all be filled. People loved it for a short period of time. But it was a hard game. And I think it took maybe too much of a toll on people, or they didn't see any benefits from it, but they didn't play hard enough, you know, to see the benefits. But during that time, I won about 25 tournaments, and locally mostly, and then some away, some great wins away. And I played for Ectolan. Ectolan gave me all the equipment, clothes, and whatnot. And that's as professional as I ever got. Okay.
You were sponsored.
That's it. I was sponsored.
That's good.
And then while I was playing racquetball, I had another love. Now remember, I'm coaching baseball, I'm coaching baseball, and I've found another love, which was baseball turned to softball. And softball had a tournament every weekend. Exciting, slow pitch softball. Exciting, dramatic, passion-filled ball. And I just said, we got to get involved in this. And I played with a local team where we won 12 tournaments in 3 years, all the local tournaments. We were 12-0. And then we decided to step outside of our local region and learn what was out there in the real world. And that was a whole nother lesson. But I culminated my softball career in 1981 when I got into the casinos. I worked for a guy who ran a casino who wanted to have a softball team. He played racquetball and I played with him in racquetball. Instead of beating him, I took him to tournaments and said, you know, here, you play in this division, I'll play in that division, we'll play doubles together. And I realized that just him coming over and me getting dressed and beating him wasn't getting me anywhere, right?
Had to play a different angle.
A different angle, yeah. Right. Street knowledge, right? Took me a little tough to eat my pride, but nonetheless, yeah. I had to do it. And but I never lost on one purpose. I never did that. More ethical than that. So we went to the softball world. I became commissioner of all softball in the 3-county area. And the last major tournament I played in was an industrial class A tournament in Kansas City, Missouri. And I was elected first team All-American in that tournament. And that really solved all that I had in me and knew that I wanted to move in a different direction and get involved in business. While I was teaching, coaching, playing softball, running softball, I also sold printed sportswear and uniforms to teams and organizations. And I did better in that than I did in teaching financially. And I would work by appointment only. And so I was busy. I was busy, very busy. And I was hustling.
That's a hustle. That's the Atlantic County hustle right there.
That's what I knew to do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If you didn't, instead of going out and robbing somebody, if you didn't have enough money, why don't you just work some more? And get enough money. That was my motto. Just get enough money. Just get where you're comfortable.
But you probably, I would imagine, met a ton of people through all that and built really good relationships. But it was a hustle. People that didn't grow up around here, Atlanta County, they don't a lot of them, I think, don't see that, but that's what people, a lot of people did back then. I mean, I think you took it to a pretty high level, but you know, even today you have your, you know, your teachers that are lifeguards in the summer that also have a second, third job out on the side. Like that's, it's common around here. If you're not necessarily locked into a professional services type environment, to just piece things together and find a way to, you know, to make yourself whole and your family whole.
Yeah. And I think if they need money, shame on them for not using those 10 weeks that they're off to go get it.
Right.
If the opportunity presents itself.
Yeah.
For example, well, I won't get into it too much, but in the casino business right now, we have a summer jobs that pay $25, $30 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be damned if we can find anybody that wants to work.
Yeah.
All those teachers should be our target audience. We don't have one.
Wow.
And we've tried to solicit them.
Yeah.
But yeah. I'll get into that later.
But yeah, so you're, you know, you go through all that and this is getting to the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s. You know, you're married, you get married to my mother, Susan, and then I'm a thought along the way. And this is, what year was it that you transitioned and decided that it's time for something new?
81.
1 year before I'm born.
Right.
Okay. So talk about how that came to be.
Well, that same guy was loved softball and racquetball, right? I told him, I said, listen, I think I want to work in your industry. He said, what do you want to do? I said, well, I want to be a casino host. Well, that was like asking for the moon back then. But I saw the guys that were doing it. And I said, I think I can do better. And so he supported it, gave me an interview, got me an interview with a guy who basically trashed me the whole interview. Didn't want to do it, but he put his foot down. They hired me. And soon I became head host. And then, you know, I left the Tropicana and went to the Golden Nugget, where during the heydays of the Golden Nugget, with Steve Wynn and Diana Ross and Frank Sinatra and all the glamour that was ever brought to Atlantic City. We used to have a, I don't know, 200, 300 seat showroom, and we'd bring acts like that in there. So you can imagine the play we had to bring to try to cover those acts. And I was part of that. And mostly what they made me do, the biggest break I ever got, I was to greet all the VIPs coming in on the VIP weekends. I had to stand by the VIP station and greet them. And all the other hosts would say, oh, you got a bad deal. I said, no, good. You think it's a bad deal? I'll talk to you later. And I met every one of them. Well, lo and behold, when things didn't work out at the Golden Nugget because they kept bringing in their own guys for me to train and them to promote, I left and I went over to Trump Marina. I didn't go to Trump Marina. I went to the Atlantic City Hilton, but they didn't get a license. And Trump came in and bought it. So now I'm going from Steve Wynn to Trump. But nonetheless, I've got a lot of people I met, a lot of people I know. And I decided instead of being a host, I wanted to be a salesman. I wanted to be in what we call player development. And I had a great bank of business. I was a leading player development guy at the Trump Marina at that time. And I got some Trump stories if you want to go into it.
We can do whatever you're comfortable with. I mean, he's kind of out there in the world pretty good. So people know a lot of things about him.
He is that. So
feel free.
One of the great stories they bought Mar-a-Lago. Okay. So I got two players that were spending $1 million a year with us. And I make arrangements for them to visit Mar-a-Lago. And we're going to stay for the weekend, Thursday to Monday. So we set the whole thing up. Ivana Trump comes up and says, they'll not stay Thursday to Monday. They'll come in Saturday, stay Sunday, and go home Monday. I said, Ivana, these people, you can't tell these people this. They might not be you, but they're wealthy people, and they're spending a lot of money. They're your customer. Lo and behold, we couldn't bring them. I had to go down there with my boss, his wife, and your mother, and just sit there and have all this service and everything, like as if we were royalty. Boy, I tell you what, I was as uncomfortable as I could possibly be. So the next year, we decide to run a sales contest. Whoever gets the most people gets to go down there. Oh, I stayed in Mar-a-Lago, by the way. I stayed in the suite that was featured in Town and Country. And so I got the use of the whole place. The next year, the contest was whoever gets the most players would go down and be the host. So I won. So I was the host of inviting 200 people to a cocktail party and then another 40 or 50 people to overnight stay, and maybe it was 30 or 40 people overnight stay, and dinner, a big dinner on Saturday night. So lo and behold, cocktail party starts. It's raining hard. Can't get around. You can't walk out on the grounds. So we're all in this one room. I'm waiting. Ivana comes out, dressed to the nines. Where's Donald? So I don't know, Ivana, I'm not sure. And lo and behold, he was with Marla Maples. So
whoops.
He doesn't show up. She walks around for 20 minutes. I'm introducing her. She leaves, goes back to her suite. Now it's me and 200 people, no Donald Trump. Yeah, he's right around the corner. I didn't know what to say. All I was worried about, somebody's going to steal an ashtray or whatever was going to happen. And, you know, this was a gaming crowd. And he comes in finally at like last 15 minutes and gets up and makes his little speech and whatnot. Then takes me and Ivana around and says clever things like, watch this guy, you know, about his wife. I mean, what are you talking about? That was Donald Trump. And that's a true story. Man. And that was my claim to fame. We had dinner. The night we had dinner, Saturday night, everybody went around and said what they did, right? And I got my turn. And I stood up and what I had done all that weekend. I check baggage and make sure you get on the bus at time. That's what I do. So one guy says, he gets the last guy, and he says, well, I don't know about you people, but I eat this way every night. That was a funny line. I've never forgotten that line. He's a cool guy, that guy.
Yeah, yeah. So you're, you know, working your way through host / you know, player development, which is really, as you described, when I talk about it in our industry, I compare it to commercial real estate brokerage. That's right. You know, we're outsourcing clients and deals, but you're sourcing gamblers to come into the casino. That's and I assume being compensated in some way, shape, or form based on your production.
A lot of salary with bonuses, but it was mistakenly put together back in the day with salaries.
Right.
It should have been a small salary and bonuses.
Yeah, which could have been very large if you're very successful, right?
Now the salaries just go up and up and up in order to keep the guy happy and in place.
Right.
And his production could go down and he could still, you know, generate more salary. So it's a little broken model.
Right. So as we move into the 90s, you start to shift more into marketing, which is more on the strategic front with, you know, the casino and how do you generate more overall activity in the place. You start to get into other elements of the casino, like entertainment and the hotel and things like that. So talk about, you know, what was your first, in your mind, your big break that kind of launched you in more the marketing side of the business and less the host and player development? And what was the timing on that?
Well, it's funny how that happened. First of all, we all left. We had a leader named Bucky Howard who got himself in a little bit of a jam, who got himself out of the jam. So we all left Trump Marina and went to Showboat. And at Showboat, I was still doing player development. But
and what year is this?
This is 1988.
Okay.
Yeah. And so anyway, I'm still doing player development. And lo and behold, Bucky leaves Showboat and goes to the Taj Mahal. And everybody followed him to the Taj Mahal. I was reluctant to go, but at the last minute I went. At the Taj Mahal, it was cluster blank, right? I wanted no parts of it. I was doing good. I was generating business, but there was a lot of hanky-panky going on. So I stayed there 10 months, and Showboat wanted me to come back. So I went back to Showboat to run the VIP marketing, mostly table games and the reservation center for the slots and whatnot. And we did well. We overachieved, because the Showboat wasn't built for that kind of business. Didn't have entertainment, didn't have the best suites and rooms and whatnot. Had some pretty good food, but it had great player development people. I had a great team there, super team. All of them are successful today, all of them. So anyway, from there, Harrah's bought Showboat. And when they bought Showboat, they started all their Harrah's stuff. You know, great thinkers, nobody smarter in any room they've been in. It just frustrated me. I'm a street guy. I know what to do. I can put anything on paper. I'm educated. If you want to see a presentation, maybe I can't do the fancy things on the computer, but I can get somebody to do that for me. But my ideas can go in there. I got nowhere with them, and I wasn't comfortable. And the job opened up at resorts, where I met my current boss, George Papineer. And I went to resorts with the idea that they were going to do a $600 million redo. And when I got there, or $500 million, when I got there, I wasn't there 2 days to find out. It was more like $50
million. Wow.
Okay. So now I'm at resorts. Politics are getting tough. Place is not going well. It had been doing well, but since the renovation, it was doing worse. And I've got all the marketing now. For the first time, I have everything. I have the mass marketing, and that's where I learned the lesson. And I have the player development. I have the VIP marketing. I have everything. But I trusted the people in the mass marketing department to come up with the solutions for the calendar and the style in which we recruited customers. And they were off the mark. And I made the mistake of trusting them. And I learned a lesson, a negative lesson. Anyway, long story short, the job only lasted 10 months. The other group was out in about 15 months. So they cleaned house and sold the place, sold their interest out. Got out. We wanted no parts of Atlantic City. And that's how I started in the overall marketing that yeah. way. But now I'm without a job.
Right. First of all, I got to rewind a little bit to the Showboat and a couple of my memories there. I don't know about all the business because I was like six when you started there, but I know that the arcade was amazing. And the bowling alley was sick. You had a nice big office overlooking the ocean. You had a typewriter that I would mess around with. Out of the bullpen, I think that was your secretary's typewriter. You had no methods of computer or typing at all.
No.
You had some legal pads and things like that. But we would go on Saturday a lot of times because your Saturday schedule was typically like you might play golf in the morning and then grab us, me, Paul, and Dana, and go into the property around maybe 2 o'clock.
Yep.
And you'd hang with us for a while and then you had to go work and you'd drop us at the bowling alley and or the arcade and just let us go to town. And we had such a good time doing that. Mm. I mean, so much fun. And then we'd hook up for dinner in the property. And then the most frustrating part of the evening would happen for me was when you were walking out of the property and we couldn't get through the lobby without you talking to 62 people. And I would pull at your leg and like, oh, please, come on, can we leave? And it was just, I mean, you know, growing up now as an adult in work situations, I understand it. But at the time, it was excruciating to leave that place.
Yeah.
But we had a great time.
You guys did have a good time there.
It was
a special place. It overachieved in business levels. It did have some nice elements to it. They all got ripped out and it all became gaming specific. But now it's, ironically, the place is no longer a casino hotel and they just built a water park.
Right.
So tell me, you know, what works. I'm surprised they don't put a bowling center back in it.
They should.
Yeah.
But and the other quick story I wanted to tell too is that you guys had a Super Bowl party one year and you know, I was young, very young. I think it was in second grade. I know I was in second grade because that's the second part of the story. But there was like, it was like halftime and there was some kind of raffle being run or something like that. And somebody won a prize and they were up on the microphone and they were like stumbling over their words and drunk, you know, and somebody from the crowd yelled, "Hey, somebody get this guy another drink." And then, you know, laughter exploded and stuff like that. So one of the next day, maybe even the next day, I'm in school. And Mrs. Connolly, my teacher, she kind of stumbles over a word. And I yell in the class, "Hey, somebody get this lady another drink."
Oh, jeez.
And I didn't know. It just was like, well, I got a laugh in this other venue. And I didn't know what it meant. I didn't even know the person was drunk. I'm 7 years old. But I said it. And it was maybe the one time in second grade that my parents got called or sent to the principal's office or something like that. It was not well received by Mrs. Connolly. But, yeah, you learned some colorful language hanging around the casino time to time.
Yeah, well, it wasn't always the best environment to put you in.
But hey, we developed a little of the street smarts that we wouldn't have otherwise had growing up in Northfield, New Jersey versus Atlantic City, Ducktown.
Yes.
But so anyway, and also the other thing I wanted to say is that during that time period and throughout our whole childhood, you know, you're working, you're growing your career, you're busy. You're not working 40 hours a week. You're working 50, 60, 70 hours a week. Saturdays, you know.
Always on the phone.
Always on the phone. But you were at, I don't know, 95% of our games. I mean, you didn't miss many.
No.
And you might have to be on the phone in your suit, you know, the big giant brick phone, the big gray phone, whatever it took. But you were doing it. You didn't miss almost anything. Whether it was a game or one of Dana's dance recitals or a school event, like you found a way to get there.
Well, I had a kind of a overall type cover that I would put over the suit and I'd leave it in the trunk and I'd go to the game and I'd put it on and I'd change my shoes and I'd watch the game or practice even, right?
Yeah, because we'll get into that. Well,
first of all, you know, the games were important to me because I owned the team, right? Julie's Giants. And
Giants.
So I watched your soccer games, your baseball games, then Paul's baseball games, football games. Dana's soccer, she was really good. She gave it up. I could almost knock her in the head for that. She was really very good. I'll never forget her running down the field one day. I'm just coming into the game. I'm a little late. Game started. I'm running down the field and a boy's running right by her. And she just takes her left elbow and knocks the kid, knocks the kid off of her and knocks him down and goes on and plays. And she had this left foot in soccer where she scored like 20 goals as a JV team or something like that. And I couldn't get her to be summertime. She just was interested in her bikini and the beach. And I couldn't get her to stay as interested as I wish she had.
Yeah,
but you know, she's a fabulous person. She knew what she wanted to do. She's doing it today. And so I shouldn't trade a single minute for it.
And then, of course, Michael later on with his everything, his baseball, his football, his golf. But I'm jumping around a little bit. But one of my favorite Mike stories is when you had to umpire one of his Little League games and you were out of third base umpiring. And there was a play where the pitcher was not yet on the dirt. He wasn't on the mound. And one of the kids stole a base. So the play was still continuing. He went from second to third, something like that. And the coach of the other team said, no, the pitcher was on the dirt. He's got to go back to the base. And you're like, oh, that's not the rule. And then the other coach of the guy who had advanced that was safe also said, yeah, you're right. Send him back. It's okay. Go back to the base. And you said, well, if you guys don't want to play by the rules, I don't need to be here. And you walked off the field.
Never umpired again.
And not only did you walk off the field, most people that if they did that, they would just like go home or maybe go far away. You just went to the backstop to watch the game.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's
no
right.
Shame. No embarrassment.
No. If you're going to be stupid and not play the game, you know, you don't need me.
Right. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. But, yeah. You know, there's we could have another separate podcast on just the sports stories. But going back to resorts, now I can remember this well because I was a senior in high school. And I can remember the day that you came home and that had happened. And it was not a great day.
No.
You know,
it was devastating. It was the first time it ever happened to me. And in my career, in my life. And, you know, I was upset and wondering what's my next step. I wasn't broke, so I wasn't worried near term. But by the same token, because I had saved, but by the same token, I wasn't done my career. I had too much career left in me.
Right. And I'm 17 years old, and I'm one of the four children that's got to go to college.
Right.
And college is not cheap.
College expense. Right.
So it was a stressful time. And I can remember that was the fall, I think, of my senior year. Maybe it happened in the summer leading into the fall. I don't know what it was exactly. But I remember you having to go up to, it was at Brooklyn a bit, right, to start?
Yeah. So in order to survive, I got a consulting job on the boat to nowhere. And I went up there and I consulted. Drove up there every week, stayed there during the week, and then, you know, had an apartment up there, and the boat to nowhere was going nowhere, trust me. No, I mean, when I say nowhere, I don't mean in the water. I mean in the business levels. And it just wasn't drawing people. And it was, we tried a lot of things to make it work, and it didn't work. So eventually, I was hanging out and got a phone call, or I got on the phone and I called Carolyn Wagner. Carolyn Gilby was her name at the time. And I said, I understand you have a job in Chicago, you know, as a marketing job in Chicago. Do you think I could put my resume in? And they said, no, I said, I had put my resume in. And she said, okay. Well, I'll talk to Roger. I think we'd love to have you. So I talked to Roger Wagner, and a few conversations, I was to be hired. Turns out my resume went to East Chicago, the same place, same address that Trump had. My resume went to Trump.
Oh.
And had they called me first, I would have been working there.
Wow.
So instead, I got involved with the Jack Binion. One of the greatest operators of all time. And he had a casino, two casinos in Chicago, the Empress, one in Illinois and one in Indiana. And I worked at the one in Indiana. And that was a rough beginning. I had a tough time with management and whatnot because I knew a lot more than they knew. And I guess I was trying to deliver it properly. And maybe I was coming off as a know-it-all, you know.
How old were you at this point?
I was in my 40s, early 50s.
Oh, yeah.
Early 50s. Yep. Yeah. And anyway, we settled after a year. We settled down. And then I had the responsibility of rebranding Empress into Horseshoe. And what a pleasure that was, and what an experience that was. And by the time I left Chicago, I used to go downtown a lot. And, you know, you had to be careful drinking and driving, and you had to, you know, figure out how to be safe and whatnot. By the time I left Chicago, there was no Uber back then or anything like that. they gave me car service to go down anytime I wanted to go down.
Yeah.
And that's when, while I was out there, that's when Paul was playing football, and I was missing Paul's football, Paul's baseball, Dana's, growing up, and Mike was with me.
Yep.
So, we had plenty of time to spend with him, but I was burning to watch Paul's football. It was his senior year, and they were going to have a great team, and they certainly did.
Yeah, they did.
They won everything. And I turned around and said to my boss, listen, I'd like to fly home on Friday, come back Saturday. So you do whatever you want. So I flew in for 9 games.
That's right.
I made 9 games out of 10.
Yeah.
And then I made the championships too, so it was more than that. So
I think that was my junior year in college, and I came with you to a bunch of those.
Yeah.
And I can remember, actually funny, I remember a funny story from that. So every time you came back, there was usually some coordination. You'd either have to rent a car,
yeah,
or I might pick you up, or Grandma Rita would help you out somehow. You'd swing by their house. So I remember you called my phone once at Villanova, the regular, landline. And as you do, you don't really say hello. You just go into what you're going to say. You're like, I'm coming in Friday, and I want to fly in. I need you to pick me up. I'm going to go here. And then don't worry, Rita will take me back. And you went into this thing, it must have lasted 2 minutes. And at the end, you go, you know what? This is too complicated. I'm just going to rent a car. You had a whole conversation with yourself. I remember playing that for my roommates, and they were dying. They just thought it was the funniest thing. He just had to work it out verbally on my voicemail, and now he knows what he wants to do.
This is direct. It's always been me. Got me in a lot of trouble a lot of times.
Well,
very successful tool.
Yeah.
Because you know why? There was no misunderstandings.
No.
Straightforward.
It's very clear.
Right at you.
Yeah. But that was a lot of, I was in college that whole time where you were living in Northwest Indiana.
Right.
And yeah, Paul and Dana were in high school. Mike was with you guys and coming home in the summer. And, you kept a place back here because in Southern New Jersey, because you wanted somewhere to come home to. And I took the liberty of using that place for a couple of gatherings that may have pushed, one of them might have pushed 100 people.
It single-handedly ruined the neighborhood. But I'll never forget the day we were moving out of there and into another house we were going to rent. Or no, into a condo.
Yeah, I think the condo off of Ocean Heights.
And the condo to a house we rented, which we eventually bought. All these moves are in a very short period of time. But anyway, I never forget I'm leaving. And a lady across the street, I figure she's going to say goodbye to me. She comes over and says, I'm so happy you're getting out of here. You were the worst tenant, anybody, worst person that ever lived in this neighborhood. And I said, what do you mean? What are you talking about? We knew you had done some things in there, but we didn't know to the magnitude.
Oh my gosh.
And then when I found out Paul gave the key to, what was the big kid's
John
name?
Rochford.
John Rochford.
Shout out to John, Johnny Rock.
He gave the key to John to use the place whenever he needed it.
Yeah.
He lived down the street. And I said, oh my gosh. Oh my God.
It wasn't until I was much older that I looked back and said, wow, that just wasn't a good approach on our part, and probably put you guys in a whole lot of liability situations that thankfully never came to be. But so I apologize, but we enjoyed it too.
Apology accepted.
Yeah. But there was a lot of back and forth, and then a few years of that, place was very successful, right? Horseshoe.
Oh,
hit it out of the park at that point, right?
Legendary successful. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, so successful that it got the company sold. Sold to Harris again, of all people.
Right.
Right? Here they come again.
Mm-hmm.
And they come with their stories. And one of the guys who was president, turned out to be the regional president of Atlantic City, he had been reaching out for me saying, hey, listen, when this deal's done, I want to bring you back as marketing guy over two places. Well, lo and behold, somebody he favored wanted to come back. So he said, I'll bring you back as vice president of special projects. Kind of a nonsense job. But they were going to pay for me to come home, pay for me to work there, working for Harris again. And that wasn't an enjoyable thought. And that lasted about 10 months as well. And then, you know, all of a sudden, I got the job of head of marketing up in, not Foxwoods, the other,
Mohegan Sun.
Yeah. I get the job, and then I get a call from Roger saying, hey, listen, we're buying 5 casinos. One of them is the Atlantic City Hilton, and you can be a part of that. You can be assistant general manager and run the marketing for that property. And so the general manager, I sat down with the general manager, and she was as nervous as anybody I've ever seen. Here comes this guy, and my reputation preceded me. And apparently it was one that said, you know, this guy's going to get results one way or the other. And they were uncomfortable because they had a nice little country club atmosphere there at the time. And so I came in. The next day she resigned. And my Tony Rodio, who I had just met at Harris, he was interviewing for the same position that I was interviewing for at Resorts because he wanted out of Harris too. He had been there a while, but he was fed up. So I said to Roger, why don't you bring Tony Rodio down here as a president and chief executive officer, and I'll work for him. I think that'll work out just fine. And he came down, and we killed it. And just knocked it out of the park.
The Rodio-Giuliano combo was epic.
Yeah.
You guys really drove tremendous success at both Hilton and Resorts, which were they under the same ownership at the time?
Yeah.
Is that how it worked?
Yeah.
Okay. So both of those places experienced a renaissance there from, what was that, about 04 to 08, 05 to 08?
Yeah, 05 to 08.
Okay. I mean, great events, put up huge numbers. I remember the night we met the Sopranos there at the Hilton. That was a great night. And I saw Paulie Walnuts in the library or in the lobby the next morning. And I said hi to him. He goes, yeah, what's up, kid? funny guy. But, you know, a great time period in your career there, for sure.
Yeah.
And you and Tony just became wonderful friends and worked incredibly well together. It felt like, even just from afar watching you guys really complimented each other extremely well.
Well, it started in the morning with a call, probably around 8 o'clock. And it was him screaming at me, yelling, what are you doing here? What's going on? Why, how can we be so bad? I said, Tony, dude, relax. We're going to be okay. And here's a guy, excitable guy, intense guy, talking to an intense guy, excitable guy. And yet we made a marriage. I grew to respect him. He grew to respect me. One of the funny things we used to do, we used to have this big marketing meeting. And we invited everybody, operations and everybody. It was really the meeting of the week in the property, and where we laid out everything we were going to do. And I used to sit down at one end, and he sat at the other end, a big long table. And he would come up with ideas, and somebody else would come up with an idea. And I might not be in on that idea. I had already laid out some ideas. They were accepted or not, you know, whatever. And he would come up with an idea that I didn't like. And he'd look at me, well, what about you? And I had a little bowl of water. And I said, Tony, you remember Pontius Pilate? Well, I'm washing my hands with this program that you have here, right? He laid the blame somewhere else, and I'm laying the blame somewhere else. And we operated that way. But it worked. It worked. We had, I'll never forget, first year, we had done 30 million. We came in and we did 52. So I said, well, my God, what an improvement. Over 1 year.
EBITDA,
52. So our reward was we got a budget for 63. So I learned a lesson.
Yeah.
Don't give them too much too fast.
Right, right. A lot of us have heard that story before.
Yeah.
Especially in the commercial real estate business, you had that kind of success and, you know, okay.
Actually,
you grew 40%, give us another 40.
Actually, the truth of the matter is we wouldn't have backed off a little bit.
Right. You
know, but I just say it that way.
One of my favorite memories from that time period was, I thought one of the coolest things you got to do was the beach concert in Atlantic City where you brought the Beach Boys in. And it was probably, what, 30, 40,000 people?
Yeah.
Estimates ranged from
25,000.
25 to, you know, some paper printed 60. It's a lot of people.
Regardless,
you're on the stage. You got to introduce the Beach Boys. Well, on the stage in your hometown in front of tens of thousands of people.
Yeah, but that really wasn't the way it went down.
Okay.
What happened was the entertainment director came over and said, they're not using the vendors. They're not buying anything. Can you go up there and get them stimulated? Well, I'm not going to go up there and tell them, hey, go buy something, right? So I go up on stage and I said, this was a rock star moment. And I'll never forget it as long as I'm on this earth. And I got to say, Atlantic City! And 30,000 people, they screamed and yelled. I said, oh my God. I said, see all this around you? I didn't do this. The marketing team did this. They put this all together. It was a beautiful day that day.
Oh, gorgeous, yeah.
I said, but you know what? I was in charge of the weather. How did I do? And they went, I started screaming because it was a beautiful day.
Yeah.
And that's about as far as I took my introduction to the Beach Boys.
Right. But it was cool. I mean, we were, me and Paul and a few of us were up in the VIP section right up front.
Right.
And behind the rope, you know, a little, I don't know, 30 by 30 area in front of stage. And we got to watch this legendary band in Atlantic City on the beach in July. And you're right, a gorgeous, perfect day.
Perfect weather.
10 out of 10 beach day. And it was a great night. It was a lot of fun.
It was special.
So that run goes about three years and change. And things really start to change in Atlantic City with the introduction of gaming in Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah.
And
the recession.
And the recession, yeah. So we're talking 07, 08. And the PA casinos were 07 or 06?
Yeah, approximately 07, I think.
Yeah. I can remember reading something in the paper, in the press of Atlantic City. Actually, it might have been Rodeo that said it. He anticipated like a 10% drop off in revenue in the near term. And I don't know what the near term numbers was, but what happened was between the recession and Pennsylvania casinos opening, as I remember it, went from a $6 billion revenue industry in Atlantic City to about
$3.2 billion. Yeah, that's how much it lost.
Half the revenue goes away.
50%. And it was this ugly time.
Yeah.
And still, we could have navigated through the time. And we weren't going to do the numbers that we had been doing. Okay,
right.
That wasn't happening. But ownership didn't really understand. And we explained to them, we think we can keep you in the black. That's as good as we can do. Marginally less than the black, a little bit less. That's all that's going to happen. We're losing revenue by the millions. This is obvious every month. Just look at the numbers from around town. Oh, no, that's not going to happen. You're wrong. And they fire Rodeo. And as soon as they fired Rodeo, they zone in on me. Take a few months to get me. They get me out of there. Meanwhile, we write a plan for them to succeed. And I'm convinced to this day it would have worked. And they bring in a guy who had sold them a bill of goods, who had run a property within the five property brand. Down south, name market escapes me right now, but it wasn't going to work up here. And I was happy to see, I hate to see a man fail, but I knew he was going to fail at this. Well, he didn't fail. He went to -20 EBITDA, and -12 EBITDA, calling the -12 a success. It was a colossal failure. And then subsequently, we had brought a body of people that were interested in buying this Hilton for $300 million. Well, they had paid $440 million. So they believed that they could get $440 million for it. Well, that wasn't happening, okay? So we gave them a buyer for $300 million, which, to tell you the truth, I would have felt bad for the buyer and later went back and warned them not to do it. So anyway, they wind up with nothing.
Place. Yeah, they sold for 18 million, 20 million?
I don't even know if they were in that sale.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It may not have been. Yeah. But the property eventually traded for about 18 or 20 million.
Yeah, eventually it did, but it might have been somebody else.
From having a $300 million offer not very long before.
Yeah.
And that's how quickly things fell apart in AC. But obviously, that doesn't last forever. And today, it's a little bit of a brighter story than that. But at the time, back in 08, when that ends, once again, you're left to figure out the next move. And the next move, again, takes you out of the area.
Rodeo gets a job in Cincinnati at an Argosy, in a former Argosy place in Lawrenceburg, which becomes a Harris. And he asked me to consult for him, not in marketing, in casino operations, because they have a marketing wing, and all the marketing is going to come from that wing. At the same time, he sends my good buddy and today my partner, Matt Cole, young man who we met at the Golden Nugget, who just had a very, very good instincts and a great understanding, a wonderful understanding, I should say, of the business at a very early age. I'm talking 23, 24, right. 25 years old.
Who's we refer to as the work son in this family.
Right.
Matt Cole, work son.
Right.
Yep. Okay.
And he proceeds to get a consulting deal as well. So we're both down there consulting, and I've got an office and he's got a cubicle. One day they come into me and say, "Hey, listen, man, you got to give up the office. I'm going to put you in the cubicle." I said, "Why don't you put me with Matt?" So I go with Matt, and there began my real career in marketing, right there. At that point, when Matt and I sat and discussed all the ways in which we would attack any company situation we found ourselves in. In other words, we would market to the point of diminishing returns. We'd find what the return was and market to that point. And we would generate profitability in that manner. And if a place was run perfectly, we'd throw our hands up and say, "We can't do much for you." We found a lot of broken places.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of broken places. And, I took a job where we beta test sited, it was a beta site, and we tested our direct marketing up at that and our calendar planning up in Rhode Island at Twin River. Now, Matt was separated from me. I have nothing to do with him and the companies that I was working at, obviously, right? But he was to go out and get business beyond just the Twin River company, and which he did. And anyway, the success that we encountered, this is where I meet George, not re-meet George Papineer, who had fired me, but he had always followed my career because he actually called me when I was in Northwest Indiana and wanted me to be a general manager in Louisiana. And I was looking at a payout from the sale of Harris, so I couldn't go.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't do it. And so anyway, he calls and says, "Hey, listen, I need the marketing guy. I see your resume. Are you interested?" And I said, "Yeah, sure. We have some good stuff we think we'd like to apply to a situation, if the situation is right. And I'll come up there." I figured I'd last a couple of years up there. And lo and behold, we get up there And I forgot the important part. I said, by the way, what is the tax rate on the slots? You know, he said 72%. 72%, I hung up. I got 28% of the dollar.
Yeah, you don't keep 72%. 72% goes out.
72%.
You keep 28. Yeah.
You keep 28%. You got to run the whole operation on that. So I figured there's no room for me to grow that business. But he called back, or I called back. I don't remember which. And I turned around and took the deal and moved up there, away from my family. Used to see Lisa and Mike and you guys once a month, if that. And, it turned out to be the beginning of a Grand Slam home run.
Yeah, but the beginning of what would become the hat and shirt you're wearing today.
Yeah.
Bally's. Yeah. With the eventual acquisition of Bally's and then rebranding the company as such, starting from the place in Rhode Island was coming out of bankruptcy, right?
Yes, it was.
Yeah. So going from really defunct, almost defunct, not defunct operating, but in Chapter 11, right?
Yeah.
And bringing that into success and then acquiring a bunch of other properties and then, you know, getting some big overseas investments, becoming a public company. Just, it's amazing to hear you say, you know, what happened in 2008, you're at the age of 61 years old. It was the beginning of the biggest growth trajectory of your career, right?
That's
fair to say?
That's right.
Yeah.
So you think you would be tired by then, but it invigorated me.
Right.
You know, the challenge just invigorated me. We started with the purchase of Hard Rock in Mississippi. We found it. Matt actually found it. He told George about it. And by the way, I don't want to forget, George and I have become the best of friends, one of the greatest leaders I've ever worked for. And, there was Tony and there was George, two different personalities completely. But what a beautiful man.
Yeah.
And I love him to death. So anyway, we buy a place in Mississippi, and I'm just, I'm not going to get into a lot of numbers, but we improve it materially. Okay. We then build a place that is a defensive move up in Tiverton. Actually, we bought the Newport Grand, and because the fellow there kept thinking he was going to get a table game license and then sell the place to some big casino outfit, and he couldn't get the license. So we bought it from him and then moved to Tiverton, where we won a vote same year that Trump won the election, 2016. We won a vote for table games. So we thought that very important. And we opened Tiverton. Today it's a well beyond what it was expected to do. Our next move really started the real movement.
Yeah.
And that's when Sue Kim got involved big time. And we bought Dover. And we did an astonishing thing at Dover. And today it's a tremendous success relative to what we bought it for.
Yeah.
And moved on to there to acquisitions in the South, in the form of Shreveport, another great deal, along with Kansas City, another great deal. And wherever we would buy a property that had some material value to it, and I believed some upside, some serious upside, we'd have to buy a small casino along with it, which didn't have really the opportunity.
Right.
That's why how we ended up in Vicksburg and Lake Tahoe. And today, of course, we're expanding in Chicago, and we'll open the temporary in August in Chicago. And we hope that that's as successful as it can be. And then we also have Las Vegas, and a lot of people have been reading about Las Vegas and all that's going to happen there. But meanwhile, we've got a property to run, and it's going to run as if it's never going to close. It's going to run until the day it should it ever close, until that day. It'll be run professionally, and everything will be done the way it's supposed to be done. And then we got a couple more places in the Midwest. We got Evansville, Quad Cities, and then we did make a play back in the early stages of sports betting in Colorado, bought Blackhawk, and that's, you know, that's there, and as a license, and I'm holding its own. And so that's about it. I think when the smoke clears, there'll be 17.
Yeah.
May have forgotten the place. I'm not sure. But
that's an incredible.
And then the other part of the company, the Bally name, I'll never forget. I was on a plane with George, and Sue called and said, should I buy the Bally name? And I said, my answer was, well, hell, it's going to cost $10 to $15 million to change the signage in the place. So, you know, he had a chance to buy it for $25 million, I think it was, or $20 million. I don't really remember the number. We bought the name, which gave us instant credibility, I think.
Yeah.
I think it was a good play. And then, of course, Sue's dream, right, is this comprehensive gaming company that's has every feature and every part to it, including the internet, the interactive gaming, the online betting, and sports betting. And that's what they're in the process of doing now. We bought a company called Gamesys,
mm-hmm.
out of England, Great Britain. And that merger and all of the workings and mechanics of that is still going on. And we're moving in the right direction there.
That's great. It's an incredible growth story. And one of my favorite parts of the story, not just the acquisitions and the new places and the companies, but the people that you've, younger people you've been able to work with over the years and inspire and lead. People like Sergio, people like Megan, people like your son, Paul, who entered the company a couple years ago, first in a consulting capacity and then now full-time basis. What has that been like for you to see the careers of others grow, and especially the ones that you've led and inspired? What's that mean to you?
Let's deal with Paul first.
Okay.
Because the first thing I did with Paul, we needed a director of hotel operations in Biloxi. And I said, Paul, this is an ideal position for you to start in. He's working at Four Seasons. It takes forever and a day to climb to that lofty position. Why don't you, you know, and he was doing great at Four Seasons. Why don't you give this a try? Why don't you step out and see if you can't do it? Well, the first few days on the job, I knew I had done the right thing. He had a punch list of all the things that he has seen in the property. I don't mean a construction punch list or a punch list just for things that needed to be attended to, physical things. I'm talking about processes and standards and operating procedures. He just walked around every day and did it. And I said, you know what? I think I made the right choice. And people fell in love with him down there.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And then he consulted for us for a while, and then eventually came on board as the head of hospitality, which is his position now. And he's gotten involved in a lot of construction projects along the way.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was exactly what he was supposed to do, but we were small.
Right.
And trying to stay small. So he did as much of it as he could, and he did a good job. And he still has some projects to clean up, and then he'll be involved in hospitality. So to see my son achieve to this level, it's incredibly rewarding. As rewarding is to see you achieve in your line of work too. Your achievements are as rewarding.
Yeah.
And then the other kid you mentioned, Sergio Sousa, Megan McGinnis, Neil Fernandez. They were with me from the beginning. They're still with me. They've all been elevated. Megan owns her own agency today. God bless her. I remember the day she tried to quit. I said, give me 24 hours. I'll figure it out. And I came back to her proposal that didn't raise wages. It just moved her into the private sector where she was at the agency. And consequently, we adjusted the amount of benefits we gave her in the cold hard cash, and that then she lived off of her husband's benefits, and that turned out to be just a home run.
Right,
and she's just done a fabulous job.
She's built a great company.
Built a great company, and we're her leading client. Happy to be that way. And then Neil is just a grinder. He's all things database. He's on top of everything. So very proud of him. Sergio, so very proud of him. He's an interesting guy.
He's a great guy. Yeah. I remember the commercials. What was it? Nice work, Sergio.
Yeah.
I
saw some of those commercials. They were actually pretty good.
They were good.
You know?
We'll have to do a clip of that attached to this podcast.
Megan hated them. But I said, Megan, I think these are pretty good. I just saw one the other day that I did. And I got to tell you what, I did better than a lot of these guys do on TV. And that was wild. Yeah. And then there's guys in other properties that I'm thinking of. Brian Better in Dover.
Yeah. I was texting with him the other day.
He was a manager when I met him with limited responsibility. Today he's a first-class director. Does a hell of a job down there. The guys down in Biloxi in Mississippi, a lot of great guys down there. We've been able to keep that whole player development team together, which is a strong team. All over the properties. Tony Rohrer, who is now the GM at both Lincoln is Twin River, the old Twin River.
Yeah.
And Tiverton. He was brought out of Kansas City, put in Dover, and promoted to up here. He's done a great job for us. And I had a lot to do with that. And I feel real good about it.
Yeah. So, final question. Tough question. Your career has been long, interesting, couple twists and turns, geographical changes. What is your legacy? What do you want your legacy to be?
It's an emotional moment. I want to be remembered for my results-oriented approach to the challenges in front of us, because nobody gets anything they want without results. You need to have results. And I want to be remembered as a fair man who told it the way it was and didn't sometimes maybe too abrupt, but nonetheless, never nonsense, never misleading. And then I want to be a person that loved his family.
Well, you're definitely all of those things, especially the latter. And, you know, you've always done right by us and, you know, worked your ass off to make sure that we had what we needed and what we wanted. And you've been my hero when it comes to not only work, but life. And I've always appreciated everything you've done for me. I'm glad we got to do this today. And I think this is going to be a great story for a lot of people to hear. And it's certainly going to be a great thing for us to be able to enjoy together as a family.
And remember, I promise that I'll keep you sitting in the chair to a minimum.
Our chair sessions.
I make them sit in the chair and listen to me pontificate. And they all get a certain number of chair reviews. Mike had his first one. He did pretty good.
He did.
He didn't walk out. I was surprised.
Well, thank you for doing this. And I hope everybody enjoyed it. And I love you.
Love you too, Sean.